lighter. The winds gradually ease down, but it will take quite some time. Still going to be a windy day on Sunday, but not as wet and not as windy as we're expecting on Saturday. And there's more areas of low pressure on the way next week as well, Vaughan.
Many thanks, I think, Darren. We'll undoubtedly be keeping you up to date on the weather in the coming 24 hours, so we'll make sure you stay with us. Now, though, to our book of the week, Sally Magnusson reads the final instalment of her memoir, Where Memories Go, the heart-rending account of her mother Mamie Baird's long struggle with dementia. Tonight, with help, Sally and her sisters are managing to care for their mother at home. But Mamie's dementia is reaching its final stages, and Sally knows the end will not be easy.
"Who is it that can tell me who I am?" asks King Lear in a whisper that carries right to the balcony of Glasgow's Theatre Royal. It's March 2011, and Shakespeare's tragedy has never spoken to me so directly. How could I not have noticed what a searing study of dementia this play is? In ruined, deluded Lear, one minute incoherent in rather familiar ways, and the next, astonishingly acute. I see you. I hear from him your own heartbreaking attempts to school your will and control your mind as you feel both slipping away. Oh, let me not be mad. Not mad, sweet heaven. Keep me in temper. I would not be mad. But it's when he asks his famous question, "Who is it that can tell me who I am?" that my heart beats faster. I've never noticed before that the question's real focus is on those listening. "Who is it among the rest of you," Lear seems to say, "can tell me who I am?" As he starts to lose his sense of self, the old king is pleading for someone to help define it for him. The words are directed at us. He's speaking to me. As the soft green days of spring slip by, your sense of dislocation grows. At night, you refuse point blank to be put to bed by anyone except a daughter. I try to explain that we all become terribly tired if we're up with you in the night with work to go to next day, and we have to have somebody to help us. "But somebody isn't anybody," you wail. And I know what you mean. Somebody isn't one of us. Then you say, with tears in your eyes, "I'm very scared." "Are you, Mum?" I whisper. "What of?" "Of the unspoken." You try again. "Of not knowing what's going on." But what's threatening to defeat us daughters is not so much your behaviour as our emotions. Others, the stalwart women who look after you as a part-time job, seem often to manage you better than we do. Perhaps we three sisters tell ourselves we need to hand over the reins to people who don't find tears flooding into their eyes every time you lash out or look lost. But even as I write this, my heart rebels. And here is the best thing, the very best thing of all. I watch open-mouthed as your twin sister Anna enters the room on your express summons and is not rejected. She takes your hand and you don't snatch it away. For years, Anna has copped the most bitter expressions of your ravaged personality, the most sweeping sarcasm. Today, out of the blue, you've welcomed her. "Do you remember, Mamie, we used to play the game, I packed my bag and went to London, and what did I put in it?" she ventures. You smile. This is going well. I even take the chance to slip out of the room. When I return, you're still holding hands, your grey-white heads bent close together, wavy hair against straight. "Look, I've got my sister Anna," you beam as I come in. And Anna, repulsed for so long, silenced for so many years, suddenly sings in a voice as strong as yours, a line from Stainer's Crucifixion. "God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son." Oh, help. I hold my breath. I'd give my only begotten son to make you stop that racket. Can only be a millisecond away. I realise my heart is beating too fast. And then it's going to burst, because you don't say anything of the kind. You start humming. And I don't know when I have felt such elation. I particularly despise in myself the speed with which my sympathy curdles when you screw your face up to cry. I really am ashamed of this. The tears turn on and off very fast, like a young child's, but even so, they're communicating wordless unhappiness and emotions beyond your control. I'm thinking about this as I prepare you for bed at the beginning of another night. "Where's my mother?" you've been sobbing over and over. "I don't know where my mother is." "I tell you what," I said. "Let's go up to bed. And when you're in there, all cosy and snug, you can think about your mother as you go to sleep." "How about that?"
"It'll make me sad."
"No, it won't, because we'll sing together. We'll sing Dream Angus, and you won't feel like crying anymore." I have no idea whether your mother ever soothed you to sleep this way, but you used to sing the lullaby to me, and this night I'm singing it for you. "Well, you know, hush, you're weeping, oh, all the wee lambs are sleeping, oh." I thought I was singing the lullaby to you, but of course you're singing it to me now. You rub your smooth fingers into the hollows of my neck and curl a strand of hair around my ear. "Thank you for upholding me," you whisper. Though you had trouble with the word hand earlier this evening, you can still find that one. I wish I could uphold you better, but perhaps, after all, it's enough. You have a cough, a chest infection threatening. We've told the doctor we're reluctant to give antibiotics as long as we can be sure you're comfortable. It feels wrong to pump you with drugs in order to prolong the life you're now enduring. Dropping in to see you on my way to work, I stroke this dear forehead, now finely mapped with mauve veins. From time to time, you reach out to touch me and stroke my arm. "You shouldn't be doing this," you say. "You shouldn't have to." "Of course I should," I say. "Of course I should." A couple of days later, the doctor sounds your chest and pronounces it clear. You've beaten an incipient chest infection all by yourself, and I'm jubilantly proud of you. Well done, Mum. You were never one to give up. But a new emotion follows, one that takes hold as soon as the doctor leaves and the surge of relief has passed. I realise how heavily I'd invested in the belief that there would always be a way of allowing you to leave before the worst ravages of dementia set in. I recognise the emotion as dread. Within every website about Alzheimer's, there's a section explaining the last stage of all. By then, the plaques and tangles will have destroyed the motor functions controlled by the cerebellum low down the back of the head and started to affect the brainstem itself, so that in the end, the body will forget the biological functions necessary to sustain its own existence. This stage signals the loss of everything. Even when avid for information, I've tended to pass over this bit with averted eyes and thumping heart. Watching you rave and sob and hallucinate makes us ask all over again if others could be doing this better. Is there a place where you might be protected more effectively from the desperate desolation and mental anguish of dementia's final assault? Has it been a kind of pride to think we know best and that love is always enough? The carers who are helping us nurse you at home try to reassure us that there is no better care somewhere else, no magic medication we've missed.
I think of where we've been with you, Margaret and Topsy and I, and the sore privilege it's been to accompany you into the deepest, darkest places, and sometimes to be able to turn on the lights. To do this for you, to be this for you, has been to learn how to love. And what, really, is the point of life, if not that? It's raining. The daffodils are cowering, and even the tough little primroses clinging to the bank of the burn are drooping today. I walk fast. There's a pulse of anxiety behind every step. I cannot be away for long, because you are dying. No more decisions. No more suffering that we can discern. We have all gathered to be around you, to sing you to ever longer sleeps, and keep one hand in ours. There is a small, fierce triumph in all this. Dementia has not destroyed you. It may have all but killed you, but it has not won. You have fought all the way, just as you said. You can stop now. I won't pretend that these last weeks have not been the hardest of all, or that the terrors of the tattered mind, as the poet Lorne McIntyre describes them, have not proved the most difficult to witness of your struggles. But there is something good about a death in the family, a dying achieved in the middle of chattering grandchildren, Margaret's dog knocking about with a lampshade round its neck to keep it from licking an injured paw, a huge jigsaw of Henry VIII, half finished in one corner. Phones ringing. We spend the last evening but one, sprawled all over your room in gales of laughter, as Margaret reads out a stash of old letters. Later, as we guard your final night, I find a position on the sofa where I can fix my gaze on a patch of blue duvet, watching it rise by an infinitesimal degree and then fall, softly. As a feather. Your breathing is butterfly light. Dawn arrives with the distant whistle of birds and light leaking through the windows. Topsy leans over to stroke your head and sings quietly in your ear. Song still has the power to calm you. I imagine you thinking wryly that your number must be well and truly up if we've started in The Lord's My Shepherd. You take a breath. A tiny, shivery gulp of a thing. Then the flap of flowery pyjama against your neck is still. My daughter is gazing at you. She writes to me later, I saw her entertaining the Sunday lunch crowd by playing her teeth with a pencil, singing at Hogmanay, whizzing round on a microscooter, teaching us songs in the car, bending over double when she laughed. Oh, and smiling! She just came back, almost as I watched. I slip to the window and open it wide. I'm not sure why, except that this is what people used to do in the days before anyone told them not to be silly, that souls don't fly away. Your soul, that wonderful essence of you that dementia could not destroy, has always liked to fly. Sunshine storms into your room. The rest of us look at each other. It's time to do what you would have done and have a cup of tea.
Sally Magnusson was reading Where Memories Go. It was abridged by Sarah Davis and produced by Justine Willett. For details of organisations which offer advice and support, go online to bbc.co.uk/actionline or call the Radio 4 Action Line to hear recorded information on 0800 044 044. Lines are open 24 hours and are free from most landlines. Some networks and mobile operators will charge for these calls. To take us to the shipping forecast, a slightly abridged version of Sailing By. So too, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at midnight 15 on Saturday the 8th of February. There are warnings of gales in all areas except southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, 100 miles west of Shannon, 943. Expected Malin, 947 by 1800 Saturday. Lows, Skagerrak, 978, and just north of Faroes, 971, both losing their identities. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north Utsira, south Utsira, northeast 40s. Southwesterly, backing southeasterly, 4 or 5, increasing 6 to gale 8 later. Rain or showers, moderate or good. Southwest 40s, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. Southeasterly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8, veering southerly 6 to gale 8, occasionally severe gale 9, rain or showers, moderate.